Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 168 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this episode, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 1 exam. This is going to be focused on Step 1. But this review is, I want to try out something today. I'm going to call it an integrated review. Okay, an integrated review. Where in one podcast, I will talk about biochemistry, I will talk about pharmacology, I will talk about hemonc, I will talk about GI. I will just integrate many things together with this. So let's go ahead and jump right in. So what if you get a question about a 29-year-old female? She has a history of hypothyroidism. And then they tell you that on physical exam, she lacks like vibratory and proprioceptive sense in the upper and the lower extremities. And then they tell you that she has like a positive Babinski, and she also has hyperreflexia. And then they give you a bunch of labs, and her hemoglobin is like 9. Her platelet count is, which is low, obviously. Her platelet count is 160,000, which is normal. And then her MCV is 105, and her white blood cell count is 5,100. And then, so with all these pieces of information I've given you, what's your diagnosis? What's your diagnosis? Put everything together. This person clearly has a microcytic anemia, has problems with vibratory and proprioceptive sense, has hyperreflexia. So the person is having like dorsal column symptoms. So dorsal column symptoms, upper motor neuron symptoms, microcytic anemia. What should that tell you? Well, I would hope you're telling me that this person has a B12 deficiency. And if you want to be a little more specific, this person likely has a pernicious anemia, right? Because if you notice in the Q-stem, I told you that this person has a history of hypothyroidism. Well, think about it. What is the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the US? It's Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And that is clearly an autoimmune disease. And the thing is, when you have one autoimmune disease, it increases your risk of having another autoimmune disease. So this person that already has Hashimoto's thyroiditis very likely has pernicious anemia. Okay, so let's talk about why we have those different findings, right? So obviously this person has a B12 deficiency, right? Remember that when people have B12 deficiencies, right, they will lack vibratory and proprioceptive sensation, because remember, B12 deficiency causes something called a subacute combined degeneration of the cord. Okay, a subacute combined degeneration of the cord. And when people have subacute combined degeneration of the cord, it's literally called a combined degeneration. So that means there are two pathways that don't work out so well, and it's the dorsal columns and your lateral corticospinal tract, the upper motor neuron part of your lateral corticospinal tract. So if you have those things going on, if your dorsal columns don't work, you lose your fine touch, vibratory, and proprioceptive sense. And then if your lateral corticospinal tract doesn't work, you have upper motor neuron symptoms. For example, you have things like hyperreflexia, you have muscle spasticity, you have a positive Babinski. Those are all things you observe in a person that has upper motor neuron symptoms. And then, obviously, if you have a B12 deficiency, you can also have a megaloblastic anemia, okay? You can also have a megaloblastic anemia, because if you lack B12, you will lack the ability to produce adequate amounts of DNA, because you're not able to produce adequate amounts of DNA, right? So you have like some issues with the cell division process, so you get a megaloblastic anemia. That's why the MCV is elevated in this question. So what are some high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with B12 deficiency? Well, what can cause a B12 deficiency on NBME exams? One thing that can cause a B12 deficiency is if you're vegan, right? Because if you think about it, and again, I'm not saying like, oh, by being a vegan, you get a B12 deficiency. Let's say if you're an unwise vegan, right? Because as a vegan, you already know that you should be, at least the prudent thing to do, is to supplement B12 in your diet, right? Because B12 is primarily derived from animal products, right? So you should be taking some kind of multivitamin that includes vitamin B12. And the thing is, one nice thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that your friends at the NBME, again, there's only so many ways they can ask something, right? So one classic strategy the NBME uses to make questions difficult is just to give something a different name. So instead of seeing B12 on your exam, you may see cobalamin as the answer choice. So don't be swayed by that. So B12, because you're obtaining from animal products, right? B12 tends to happen in vegans. That's one. Two, another person that can get a B12 deficiency on an NBME exam is a person that has celiac disease, okay? Or some kind of malabsorptive disorder, right? So if, for example, a person has like celiac disease where their terminal ileum doesn't work so well, or if a person has Crohn's disease where they have, again, inflammation and they've torched the terminal ileum, that can also cause a B12 deficiency, because the thing is, the terminal ileum is where B12 and its partner, intrinsic factor, get reabsorbed into the systemic circulation. So if a person's terminal ileum doesn't work right, that can cause a B12 deficiency. If a person also is taking a PPI, that can also cause a B12 deficiency, because remember, you need the acidity of the stomach for you to have the ability to separate R factor from intrinsic factor. That's, so basically, let me tell you this. Intrinsic factor binds up with R factor. So R factor is produced in the saliva. And then that R factor goes down in the stomach, it marries intrinsic factor. And then that R factor and intrinsic factor complex, they are split apart by the acidity of the stomach. And then intrinsic factor, like in the duodenum, it pairs up with vitamin B12, and then they travel all the way to the terminal ileum, and then they get reabsorbed together. So if a person is taking a PPI, right, they don't have acidity in their stomach because you've inhibited that hydrogen potassium ATPase pump that you find at the surface of parietal cells. So you're not able to establish acidity in the stomach. So that can certainly cause a B12 deficiency. That's a high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind. Now, one other thing you also want to remember is that B12 deficiency can be caused by pernicious anemia, right? Like the case in this question that I highlighted. Because the thing is that B12, intrinsic factor, right? Like you can make autoantibodies against intrinsic factor or autoantibodies against like parietal cells, right? And if you do those things, you will essentially limit the ability to produce intrinsic factor, and that can cause a B12 deficiency again, because you need intrinsic factor for B12 to be successfully reabsorbed in the GI tract. So again, if your terminal, if you have a pernicious anemia, that can cause a B12 deficiency. And I think I may have made a small misstep earlier. I don't know, like my mind just doesn't seem to agree with something I just said. So let me explain this. I think maybe walking through things in a somewhat systematic fashion will make things a little more useful. So the thing is, when you eat like dietary protein, right? Let's say you eat like, you know, a diet that contains B12. The thing is, the first thing that happens is R factor is secreted. Sometimes it's known as haptocorin. That R factor is secreted in the saliva, right? And it travels on its way, you know, goes all the way to the stomach. But the thing is, in the stomach, for you to cleave B12 from dietary proteins, you do actually need pepsin to make that happen. So pepsin, which is a stomach enzyme, cleaves B12 from dietary, like the food that you consume, okay? So the thing is, if you're taking a proton pump inhibitor, right? Because remember, pepsin is the active form of pepsinogen. And remember, pepsinogen comes from chief cells of the stomach. The thing is, if you want to convert pepsinogen to pepsin, you need the acidic environment of the stomach to make that happen. So if you're taking a PPI and you inhibit that hydrogen potassium antipodder that is found on the surface of the parietal cells, then you don't make an acidic environment in the stomach. Pepsinogen, which is a zymogen, never gets converted to pepsin. And if that happens, then pepsin will not be able to cleave vitamin B12 from the diet, like the food you consume, like the animal products you consume, and that can cause a vitamin B12 deficiency. Okay, so that's the mechanism, that's the truth. So I made a small misstep earlier, my apologies for that. But that is the primary mechanism behind uh, PPI is causing a vitamin B12 deficiency, and this is something that has been proven in the literature. But let's continue that R factor story because it's kind of high yield and important to know. So the thing is, after pepsin has cleaved vitamin B12 from your dietary, like whatever's, right? Then that B12 binds to R factor. Again, remember, another name for R factor, which you may see on your MBME exam, is haptocorin. So that R factor binds to B12. And when that R factor binds to B12, it protects it from the acidity of the stomach, because B12, believe it or not, can actually be denatured by the stomach. But R factor prevents that from happening. So the thing that happens is R factor is almost like a protecting group for B12. And those two things travel together. Those two things travel together to like the duodenum. And then in the duodenum, pancreatic enzymes cleave B12 from R factor. Okay. And then B12 can then run free, and then it can pair up with intrinsic factor that has been secreted by the parietal cells in the stomach. That intrinsic factor just travels on its own and then pairs up with B12. And then B12 and intrinsic factor, they then come together and then get reabsorbed in the terminal ileum. So if a person has like cystic fibrosis, for example, or they have like chronic pancreatitis where they are not able to make pancreatic enzymes, then that can certainly cause a B12 deficiency, because you lose the ability to cleave B12 from R factor. And if you cannot cleave B12 from R factor, then B12, whenever it's like B12 is already in a relationship, right? And intrinsic factor doesn't love to do breakups, right? So if B12 does not break up with R factor, which happens under the tutelage of the pancreatic enzymes, then you begin to have issues where intrinsic factor cannot bind to B12, and that can certainly also cause a B12 deficiency. Now, another weird thing that can cause a B12 deficiency is this bug known as Diphyllobothrium latum. Okay, Diphyllobothrium latum can consume your vitamin B12, and again, that can also cause it's a parasite. It can cause a B12 deficiency. So again, those are all things that can. So you can see how many questions your friends at the MBME can generate for a B12 deficiency question. I mean, you never knew that there's this much that can be derived from vitamin B12. So B12, again, we've kind of talked about the different things that can happen in a person that has a B12 deficiency. We talked about the subacute combined degeneration of the cord, where you lose the dorsal column pathway, right? When you lose the dorsal column pathway, and then you lose the lateral corticospinal tract. The thing is, that subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord, whenever the MBME writes questions that details that pathology, they occasionally put like two other answer choices to try to mess with people's heads. And those are answer choices that deal with anterior spinal artery syndrome and answer choices that deal with tertiary syphilis. So remember, tertiary syphilis can cause something called tabes dorsalis, where the syphilis destroys just the dorsal columns. So when a person has tabes dorsalis, the only symptoms they will have will be dorsal column symptoms. They will not have the upper motor neuron symptoms that you get from destroying the lateral corticospinal tract, because tertiary syphilis just affects only the dorsal columns, right? So again, that's something high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, one other thing you want to, sort of like lock down at the back of your mind as well is anterior spinal artery syndrome, right? So how does it classically present? Classically on MBMEs, it will present in a person that has a AAA, and that AAA was fixed with surgery, right? And then they will say that, oh, during the course of the surgery, the person had multiple hypotensive episodes. The thing is, your abdominal aorta supplies an artery known as the artery of Adamkiewicz. The artery of Adamkiewicz supplies the anterior spinal artery for multiple segments in the spinal cord. So if you infarct the artery of Adamkiewicz during the fix of an abdominal aortic aneurysm, then that can cause anterior spinal artery syndrome. And when a person has anterior spinal artery syndrome, they essentially infarct every part of the spinal cord with the exception of the dorsal columns, because the dorsal columns are supplied by the posterior spinal arteries. So that's something, again, high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. So why is B12 so important, right? Why is B12 so important? Well, B12 is important for many reasons. And one thing that your friends at the MBME love to test in the context of B12 is the relationship is like comparing and contrasting B12 and folic acid, okay? Comparing and contrasting B12 and folic acid. The thing is, when people have a B12 deficiency, their levels of homocysteine go up, Okay. If a person also has a folate deficiency, that person's homocysteine level goes up as well. And we'll talk about why that is the case in a second. In fact, that's where I'll start integrating multiple concepts real quick. Homocysteine, there's just so much knowledge you can build around homocysteine on MBM exams. So that's kind of like a big thing I will go, but that's a big concept I will go with and maybe like generate like 30, 40 different questions during the course of this podcast. So this should be a fun podcast to listen to. And then, but the thing is, when a person has a B12 deficiency, right, in B12 deficiency, you'll have elevations in your methylmalonic acid. Because as it so happens, B12 catalyzes at least two reactions that we know of in the body. One involves an enzyme known as methionine synthase. I'll talk about that in a second. But another thing that B12 catalyzes is the reaction that involves converting methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA, right? Remember the breakdown or the further metabolism of all-chain fatty acids. So B12 helps in the conversion of methylmalonyl, like the enzyme methylmalonyl-CoA mutase, which converts methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA, uses B12 as a cofactor. So if a person has a deficiency of vitamin B12, methylmalonyl-CoA would not work appropriately. And if methylmalonyl-CoA does not work appropriately, that will cause an elevation in the person's... if methylmalonyl-CoA mutase does not work appropriately, that will cause an elevation in the person's methylmalonyl-CoA level. So a methylmalonic acidemia can be caused by a B12 deficiency. So that's how you tell a B12 deficiency apart from a folate deficiency. And remember that folate deficiency, right, occurs when you don't eat plant products. And folate deficiency tends to occur more like easily than a B12 deficiency, because folate, you can run out of your stores within like 3 months. It takes years for you to run out of your stores of vitamin B12. And folate, right? Well, who are the classic people that get folate deficiency? People that eat a tea and toast diet. So it'll be like an old person that is depressed and is not having good nutrition. It can be an alcoholic. One of the most common vitamin deficiencies that develops in alcoholics is a folate or a vitamin B9 deficiency. They'll try to trick you on your exam by saying vitamin B12 deficiency. Don't choose that. Choose vitamin B9 deficiency. Because the enzyme, one of the enzymes that helps you reabsorb folate in the jejunum of the digestive tract, actually uses that enzyme is poisoned by alcohol. So alcoholics, they tend to get a folate deficiency. Remember, another enzyme deficiency that alcoholics tend to get is a vitamin B1 deficiency, thiamine deficiency, where they can get like Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Remember the triad of Wernicke syndrome, where people get confusion, and then they get ophthalmoplegia, right? So the ophthalmoplegia can be anything. It can be like lateral rectus palsy. It can be like an astigmatism, and then they get ataxia, right? And then remember, the thing that gets you from Wernicke's to Korsakoff's is if the person is beginning to have amnesia, right? So they're beginning to forget stuff, or they have confabulations, or they're making stuff up. Then that gets you from the realm of Wernicke's to Korsakoff's. And remember that Wernicke's encephalopathy is reversible. You can treat it with IV thiamine, but Korsakoff's trichosis is irreversible. And remember, many people think, at least this is something you certainly want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams, that the symptoms of Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome arise from dysfunction of the enzyme known as transketolase. Remember that transketolase is the rate-limiting enzyme of the non-oxidative phase of the hexose monophosphate shunt, which is also known as the pentose phosphate pathway. And then remember the neuroanatomical association for Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Remember that Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome is associated with hemorrhagic infarctions of the mammillary bodies. And if they give you a question about an alcoholic, you know, that comes in with like the classic Wernicke symptoms on an MBME exam, and then they tell you, what do you do first for that patient? You obviously want to give vitamin B1 or thiamine first before you give glucose, right? Because if you give the person glucose, then that glucose will flux through glycolysis. And then after glycolysis, you have the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex coming up on that. And the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex depends on vitamin B1 as a cofactor. Remember, the PDH complex uses vitamin B1, vitamin B2, vitamin B3, and vitamin B5 as cofactors, right? So if you consume glucose before you give thiamine, you'll place a need on the person's, you'll put increased demand on the person's need for thiamine, and that can throw the person into or exacerbate or worsen their symptoms of Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. So you always give thiamine first before you give glucose. And you may say, oh, Divine, this is low yield. I promise you, these are things that have shown up a lot on the USMLEs. both step one, step two, CK, step three. In fact, I remember during my intern year, I was actually pimped by an attendant on this very concept. Well, thankfully, that went well. Okay, so we said that B12 and folate deficiency can both cause elevations in homocysteine. Well, the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they actually really care about you knowing the different things that can raise a person's levels of homocysteine. And the thing is, these are things that are actually not very terrible to learn if you just try to understand them, right? So the first thing I think that really makes sense to keep in mind is, okay, what is homocysteine? Well, the thing is, homocysteine is this ubiquitous compound that we use for a lot of stuff in the body, right? We use it for a lot of stuff because it participates in a different number of reactions. But the thing is that when a person's homocysteine levels are elevated, that is not good. Because the thing is, homocysteine has very reactive sulfhydryl groups, so it can generate a lot of free radicals and cause a lot of damage. So what are the different reactions that homocysteine is involved in? Well, the first, probably the most obvious one, is that homocysteine, if you give it a methyl group, it becomes methionine, okay? If you give a methyl group to homocysteine, it becomes methionine. So where does that methyl group come from? The thing is, that methyl group comes from folate, okay? That methyl group comes from folate because, remember, folate is a very good carrier of methyl groups in the body, right? So methylene tetrahydrofolate gives that methyl group to homocysteine so that the homocysteine can become methionine. And the thing is, in that reaction, that methylene tetrahydrofolate is converted to tetrahydrofolate because it's just giving up its methyl group, okay? Now, the thing is, in that reaction where methylene tetrahydrofolate is producing, giving off the methyl group that will help you convert homocysteine to methionine, the enzyme that catalyzes that reaction is known as methionine synthase, okay? That enzyme is known as methionine synthase, right? It's the enzyme that synthesizes methionine. Well, it so happens that methionine synthase uses vitamin B12 as a cofactor, okay? So, again, make sure you keep everything straight. To convert homocysteine to methionine, you use methionine synthase as the enzyme. And I think another name for methionine synthase is like MTHFR. It's like a methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm going to call it methionine synthase for purposes of this podcast. So methionine synthase uses B12 as a cofactor. The methyl group for that reaction comes from methylene tetrahydrofolate that gets converted to tetrahydrofolate in the course of that reaction. Okay, so again, those are all high yield things to keep in mind for your exam. So if you understand what I just said, you can already see right off the bat three causes of elevated homocysteine, right? Three causes of elevated homocysteine. So think about it. If a person has a B12 deficiency, the methionine synthase doesn't have a cofactor, that'll prevent the conversion of homocysteine to methionine, your homocysteine levels will increase. If a person has a folate deficiency, then you will not have any feedstock that gives rise to methylene tetrahydrofolate, okay? And that you will not have any methyl donor for that homocysteine to methionine reaction, so your homocysteine levels go up. Alternatively, if you have a mutation or a deficiency of the enzyme methionine synthase, then you literally have like no enzyme that can also cause an elevation in a person's homocysteine, right? In fact, I will talk about that separately in a second, right? But actually, there are actually two more things that can cause elevations in a person's homocysteine. The thing is, in addition to being able to be converted to methionine, another reaction that homocysteine gets involved in is its conversion from homocysteine to cysteine, okay? Conversion of homocysteine to cysteine. And the enzyme that does that is known as CBS. So CBS, like the TV station. Although the CBS in this case stands for cystathionine beta synthase, okay? Cystathionine beta synthase is the enzyme that converts homocysteine to cysteine, okay? The thing is, it's called cystathionine beta synthase because along the way from going from homocysteine to cysteine, you have like a cystathionine intermediate. So now, the thing is that CBS enzyme actually uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor, okay? It uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. So guess what? If you have a deficiency of vitamin B6, remember another name for vitamin B6 is pyridoxal phosphate, that can also cause an elevation in homocysteine, right? So if, for example, a person is taking isoniazid and they're not listening to their doctor's advice and taking B6 at the same time, that can elevate a person's levels of homocysteine. And then if you also have a mutation or a deficiency of the enzyme CBS, right? That can also cause elevations in homocysteine, because again, the homocysteine is not able to be converted to cysteine. And it so happens that there is actually a genetic disorder that literally is associated with a deficiency or a mutation in CBS. And that's what's known as homocystinuria, right? Like homocystinuria or homocystinemia, whatever you want to call it. But it's a genetic syndrome where a person has elevations in homocysteine from a CBS deficiency. In fact, a CBS deficiency, this is very high up. A CBS deficiency is the most common genetic cause of elevations in homocysteine. Okay? Now, remember I also talked about methionine synthase. There are actually some cases of homocystinuria that are associated with deficiencies of methionine synthase. But the CBS deficiency is a lot more common than the methionine synthase deficiency. So what are the key things you want to keep at the back of your mind with homocystinuria? Well, you want to keep at the back of your mind, essentially you want to be able to compare and contrast this with Marfan syndrome. The thing is, your friends at the MBME, they love to see if you can differentiate between this and Marfan syndrome, right? So the first differentiating factor here is the mechanism of inheritance. Homocystinuria is inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. Remember, I think I may have given this trick in one of my genetic disease, my genetic disease podcast. Again, this rule doesn't always work, but it probably works like 80% of the time. So it's a rule worth remembering, right? The thing is, whenever you have an enzyme deficiency, enzyme deficiencies are almost always inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, right? And homocystinuria is no exception to that rule, right? So homocystinuria is almost always inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. Compare this with Marfan syndrome, where the mechanism of inheritance is in an autosomal dominant fashion. And again, that brings another rule. Most structural protein deficiencies or mutations tend to be inherited in autosomal dominant fashions. For example, if a person has Marfan syndrome, they have a mutation in fibrillin, autosomal dominant inheritance. Fibrillin is a structural protein. If a person has hereditary spherocytosis, right, like a mutation in the enzyme spectrin, ancrin, BAN3.2, those are all structural proteins that's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. If a person has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, they have mutations in collagen. Collagen is a structural protein for many things, autosomal dominant inheritance as well. Okay, so again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of. It's a high yield rule to keep in mind. I mean, think about von Willebrand disease. It's a deficiency of von Willebrand factor, right? Von Willebrand factor is a structural protein, right? It's a structural protein. It helps you with the adhesion step of primary hemostasis, autosomal dominant inheritance as well. So mutations in structural proteins in general are inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. Now, so back to our story of differentiating homocystinuria from Marfan syndrome, right? So we said that homocystinuria is inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. Marfan's is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. Well, in homocystinuria, I already said that again, it's associated with mutations in CBS, cystathionine beta synthase, or MTHFR, right? So like methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, which is also known as methionine synthase. On the other hand, in Marfan syndrome, the mutation is in fibrillin. Okay, remember, fibrillin is a gene that comes from a chromosome 15. That's another added tidbit of detail that you want to keep in mind for MBME exams. And then remember that people that have homocystinuria, right, they tend to have a Marfanoid habitus, just like people that have Marfan syndrome that also have a Marfanoid habitus. Now, people that have homocystinuria, they tend to have intellectual disability, okay? People that have Marfans actually tend to have normal intelligence. So if a person has an abnormal IQ on MBME exams, that excludes the diagnosis of Marfans, okay? And then another key thing to keep at the back of your mind is people that have Marfans, their lenses tend to be dislocated upwards. Contrast that with people that have homocystinuria, where their lenses tend to be dislocated downwards, okay? So again, those are all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. Now, whenever you see a person, whenever you see like the term Marfanoid habitus on an MBME exam, there are certain things you want to keep at the back of your mind in a differential diagnosis. The first one is obviously Marfan syndrome, okay? Marfan syndrome is associated with a Marfanoid habitus, but again, remember, you'll see the other findings of Marfan syndrome, like mitral valve prolapse. You will see the aneurysms in the circle of Willis, most commonly with the anterior communicating artery, right? You will see them, again, have all those other disorders like aortic dissection, thoracic aortic aneurysms, things of that nature, right? Another thing you should consider in your differential in a person that has a Marfanoid habitus is homocystinuria. Again, like I said, intellectual disability, a lot of vascular events like strokes, myocardial infarctions, right? Again, intellectual disability. They'll have like the lens dislocated downwards, right? And things of that nature. A third thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with a Marfanoid habitus is MEN2B. Remember, MEN2B, it's an autosomal dominant disease, right? Where a person has a mutation in a RET gene, okay? I remember in MEN2B, those people have, again, they have a Marfanoid habitus, they have mucosal neuromas, they have pheochromocytomas, and they have medullary thyroid cancer. Remember that calcitonin is the tumor marker for medullary thyroid cancer, okay? And then another thing that can cause a Marfanoid habitus on MBME exams is Klinefelter syndrome, right? But it'll be a guy, you know, that has like gynecomastia, like a super tall guy, has gynecomastia, has a micropenis, has very small testicles. Think about Klinefelter syndrome under those circumstances. So those are the different things you should keep at the back of your mind if you see a Marfanoid habitus mentioned on your MBME exam. So essentially, if you understand everything I just talked about, then you should know all the different things that can elevate your homocysteine. So I will summarize this, right? So if you have a B6 deficiency, right? So there are essentially five things that can cause a homocysteine elevation. If you have a B6 deficiency, remember another name for B6 is pyridoxal phosphate. CBS will not work, so you will not be able to convert homocysteine to cysteine, so your homocysteine levels will go up. If you have a CBS mutation, aka homocystinuria, okay, you won't be able to convert homocysteine to cysteine, so your homocysteine levels will go up as well. If you have a B12 deficiency, methionine synthase will not work. So your homocysteine level will also go up because you're not able to convert that homocysteine to methionine. If you have a B9 deficiency, aka a folate deficiency, you'll also have issues converting homocysteine to methionine because, again, remember, folate provides the methyl group for that reaction to go on because the difference between homocysteine and methionine is a methyl group. And then if you have an MTHFR deficiency, aka methionine synthase deficiency or mutation, that will also cause elevations in homocysteine because you're not able to convert your homocysteine to methionine. Again, those are all big high yield things to keep at the back of your mind for exams. So what if, methionine is also kind of important. I mean, like many people don't think about it this way, but methionine, believe it or not, is also a pretty great, methyl donor in the body. Okay, so the thing is, methionine can actually combine with ATP, and when it combines with ATP, it becomes a compound known as SAM, okay, S-adenosylmethionine. Well, SAM is a very key high-yield methyl donor in the body. One key reaction your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know with SAM is that SAM can be the methyl donor for the conversion of norepinephrine to epinephrine. Remember, the conversion of norepinephrine to epinephrine, that reaction actually happens in the adrenal medulla, okay? And remember that it happens under the action of the enzyme known as PNMT, okay? PNMT is known as a phenylethanolamine N-methyl transferase, okay? It converts norepinephrine to epinephrine, right? Literally, the difference between norepinephrine and epinephrine is a methyl group, okay? Is a methyl group. So, SAM provides the methyl group for that reaction to happen. And actually, just as an endocrine tie-in here, because I'm feeling like integrating this evening, the endocrine tie-in you want to keep at the back of your mind here is that PNMT is actually activated by cortisol. That is actually one of the ways that cortisol has a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system, okay? And then really in that reaction, that SAM, after it gives off its methyl group and you give off like adenosine, it actually reforms homocysteine, and then you keep that homocysteine cycle going again. Now, I also talked about methylene tetrahydrofolate and tetrahydrofolate. Well, I said that methylene tetrahydrofolate, after it gives off its methyl group, right, to methionine synthase, it forms tetrahydrofolate. Well, what are some high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with this folate business, right? Remember that that methylene tetrahydrofolate can also help you in DNA synthesis. This is one of the reasons why folate deficiency can cause megaloblastic anemia, because it can mess up your DNA synthesis, right? Because the thing is, if you want to convert DUMP or deoxyuridine monophosphate to DTMP or deoxythymidine monophosphate, the difference between uracil and thymine, believe it or not, is actually the presence of a methyl group, okay? That methyl group actually comes from methylene tetrahydrofolate. And the thing is, in that reaction, That methylene tetrahydrofolate, as it gives its methyl group to DUMP to become DTMP, it becomes dihydrofolate. Well, that dihydrofolate is kind of important for reason, because that if you want to convert that dihydrofolate back to like the methylene tetrahydrofolate, you need to convert the dihydrofolate first to tetrahydrofolate. And you should already know the enzyme that makes that happen. The enzyme that makes that happen is known as dihydrofolate reductase. Dihydrofolate reductase converts dihydrofolate to tetrahydrofolate. And then that tetrahydrofolate can ultimately be converted back to methylene tetrahydrofolate. Well, why is dihydrofolate reductase important? Dihydrofolate reductase is important because it's inhibited by multiple drugs, okay? Like it's inhibited by pyrimethamine. Remember, pyrimethamine is combined with sulfadiazine to treat toxoplasmosis, right, in like HIV patients. Remember, if they give you a question about a HIV patient that has multiple ring-enhancing lesions in the brain, right, that's Toxoplasma gondii. You can treat that with a combination of pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine. Pyrimethamine works by inhibiting dihydrofolate reductase. Now, if a person has HIV and they have pneumocystis jirovetsi, remember that you can treat that with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Well, it so happens that the trimethoprim part of TMPSMX works by inhibiting dihydrofolate reductase as well. And then, if you get a question about a patient that has rheumatoid arthritis, the first line agent for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis is the DMARD known as methotrexate. Okay, methotrexate works by inhibiting dihydrofolate reductase. So there are three high yield drugs on your exam that work by inhibiting dihydrofolate reductase: methotrexate, trimethoprim, and pyrimethamine. Okay, so those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And it so happens that, because if you think about it, if you keep inhibiting dihydrofolate reductase, you're not going to be able to regenerate active folate, and you're not going to be able to make DNA. So you can get a profound bone marrow suppression with that. Okay, so one high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that if a person has a profound bone marrow suppression from taking one of these folate inhibitors, one thing you can actually do on an MBME exam is to give a drug known as leucovorin. Okay, to give a drug known as leucovorin. Leucovorin is a folinic acid analog that can be used to rescue the bone marrow in a person that has profound bone marrow suppression in the setting of taking a folate inhibitor, classically methotrexate on MBME exams. Now, one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that leucovorin is an analog of folinic acid. It is not an analog of folic acid. They do this a lot, both on UOROD and on MBME exams, to mess up people's heads, okay? There is a difference between folic acid and folinic acid. They are not the same compound. Leucovorin is a folinic acid analog. Because believe it or not, your friends at the MBME have been known to write questions where they talk about a person that is having profound bone marrow suppression from taking methotrexate. And then they tell you that, oh, which of the following is the rescue agent, yada, yada, yada. And then they'll put an answer choice that says for administration of a folic acid analog. And then they'll give you an answer choice that says administration of a folinic acid analog. You want to go ahead and pick the answer choice that says administration of a folinic acid analog, which is leucovorin. Now, I'd also just said that that methylene tetrahydrofolate provides the methyl group for you to go from deoxyuridine monophosphate, or DUMP, to deoxythymidine monophosphate, DTMP. Well, the thing is, the enzyme that actually catalyzes that reaction is an enzyme known as thymidylate synthase. Okay, thymidylate synthase, right, helps you literally synthesize thymidine. Okay, so that's a high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, because there is actually a drug that works by inhibiting thymidylate synthase. That drug is known as 5-fluorouracil. Okay, 5-fluorouracil is a thymidylate synthase inhibitor. Okay, and it's an anti-cancer drug because, again, it prevents DNA synthesis. Now, the thing is, many people just stop their knowledge at 5-FU, but there is actually like a high yield thing that your friends at the USMLE exams may want, that I, for whatever reason, I don't find in too many resources, that actually, again, integrates some extra knowledge with 5-fluorouracil. The thing is, think about it. If they give you a question about a HIV patient that has like nuchal rigidity and, you know, has like signs and symptoms of meningitis, what is the bug that is likely causing their meningitis? Well, I would hope you're telling me that that person has cryptococcal meningitis. Remember, right? Meningitis in a HIV patient, the big thing you want to be thinking about is cryptococcus neoformans, okay? If a person has cryptococcal meningitis, I mean, obviously you can make the diagnosis by, you know, you can do like the latex particle agglutination assay. But one other thing you can actually do is, I mean, remember it's positive for India ink. So the India ink stain is pretty good for cryptococcus and neoformans. But again, these days, everyone does the cryptococcal latex particle agglutination assay. So the thing is, the way you treat crypto is actually you give amphotericin, like a combination of amphotericin B and 5-fluocidazine, okay? Now, amphotericin B, you know it's an ergosterol inhibitor, right? It binds to ergosterol, pokes holes in the walls of the fungal membrane, right? But one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is, how does 5-fluocidazine work? Well, it's a biochemistry application. So again, this is something that your friends at the MBME want you to understand. The thing is, maybe not want you to understand so that you don't get the question right on a test. But I mean, I truly believe that the people that write these questions actually really want students to succeed. But I guess that's a different conversation for a different day. But the thing is that 5-fluocidazine is actually, because think about it, what is the difference between cytosine and uracil? It's actually an amino group. Cytosine has an amino group that uracil does not have. So the thing is, if you wanted to convert cytosine to uracil, all you need to do is deaminate cytosine, and boom, uracil shows up. So it so happens that when you take 5-fluocidazine, that 5-fluocidazine is actually converted by cytosine deaminase to 5-fluorouracil to 5-FU. And then that 5-FU then inhibits thymidylate synthase in whatever bug you're trying to kill, aka cryptococcus neoformans. Okay, so again, these are all high yield things to know. So I think since this podcast, you know, it's probably gone on for a long, 41 minutes and some seconds. So I think I'm going to maybe go ahead and stop here. But again, I will try to be like, you know, make podcasts like this in the future where I start from one central concept and then begin to build all these networks. That is really the ideal way to learn, right? Because really, if you understand everything I've just discussed in this podcast, you should never, ever in your life get a B12 or a folate or a homocysteine question wrong. Because I've essentially attacked it from every possible angle, from like the neurology angle, the endocrinology angle, the genetic diseases angle, the biochemistry angle, right? I've attacked it from the micro angle, the pharmacology angle, right? I love making these kinds of podcasts because you can just sit down and again, integrate a lot of things in a very short time frame. And as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? So if you're taking any of these exams, or you know people that are taking any of these exams and need help, please feel free to send them my way. I offer tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, and Step 3 exams. And then the preclinical med school exams, the third year clerkship shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I offer tutoring for the internal medicine in training exam, the ABIM internal medicine board exam, right? And if you're a college student, right, I tutor for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, biochem, histology, physiology. And there's this thing I've been offering called a longitudinal tutoring, where if you're a first, second, or third year medical student, I tutor you for all your class exams, so I guess your shelf exams if you're a third year. And then at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exam. Okay, the vast majority of people I've done that with have been wildly, wildly, wildly successful on the exams. And then there's this thing I also offer, which is called like a booster course. For the USMLE Step 1, it's a 20-hour course. For the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams, it's a 10-hour course. And essentially, the thing I do under those circumstances is it's good for a person that is at the end of their dedicated periods, or a person that feels good about their knowledge base and they just want someone to help them put everything together in a high-yield format. Essentially, these sessions end up being like 3 to 5 sessions where we review a lot of the high-yield material that you're going to see on your exam in a very like quick, dirty Q&A high-yield format. And again, I integrate multiple disciplines. I mean, if you just listened to this podcast, you have a pretty good idea of how I integrate concepts together, right? So those are all things I can help you with this USMLE booster course. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. And then the final thing I offer, if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one advising, one-on-one like coaching for like, you know, personal statements, rec letters, editing applications, mock interviews. Again, I've done this with tons of people. And again, the overwhelming majority of people I've worked with have been very, 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 very successful, right? Most of them have matched their first choice. So again, if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. Again, I have a lot of experience with this. I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a year. So I've reviewed like thousands of applications. So I know the kinds of things that people look out for. So reach out to me if you're interested in any of these things. So I do wish you a wonderful weekend. I should be going to bed soon so I can watch the Lakers game early tomorrow morning. So I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you and God bless you.